Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, historian Mark Bray, begins his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, by writing, "I wish there were no need for this book, but someone burned down the Victoria Islamic Center in Victoria, Texas, hours after the announcement of the Trump administration's Muslim ban, weeks after a flurry of more than 100 proposed anti-LGBTQ laws in early 2017, a man smashed through the front door of Casa Ruby, a Washington, D.C. transgender advocacy center, and assaulted a trans woman as he shouted, "I'm going to kill you." A day after Donald Trump's election, Latino students at Royal Oak Middle School in Michigan were brought to tears by their classmates' chants of "Build That Wall." And the examples go on. Mark Bray believes scholars and writers have a responsibility to stand up to this, specifically to fascism. His book is an unabashedly partisan call to arms that aims to equip a new generation of anti-fascists with the history and theory necessary to defeat the resurgent far right. Mark Bray's book is based on 61 interviews with current and former anti-fascists from 17 countries in North America and Europe. He writes that the vast majority of anti-fascist tactics involve no physical violence whatsoever, but anti-fascists won't wait for a fascist threat to become violent before acting to shut it down, physically if necessary. Some of them punch Nazis in the face and don't apologize for it. When they say never again, they mean it, and they're willing to use any means necessary. Mark Bray is a longtime activist and historian of human rights, terrorism, and political radicalism in modern Europe. He's a lecturer at Dartmouth. He was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street, and he's the author of many books, including Translating Anarchy, The Anarchism of Occupy Wall Street. And he will be speaking tonight about his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, at East Bay Booksellers at 5433 College Avenue in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. He'll be in Davis tomorrow, in Palo Alto on November 16th, City Lights on November 16th at 7:30 in San Francisco. And then the Howard's Inn Book Fair is taking place on November 19th in San Francisco, and he'll be there at 12:15. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Mark Bray joins me in studio. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Wow, you're getting around for this book. Yeah. I was doing some research about your interviews. You even had a debate on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd about the tactics of Antifa.
Yeah. I mean, the timing has been surreal. But really, this is a book about timing. I call the book A History, Theory, and Politics on the Run because, as opposed to most professional historians who take years and years putting together a study, this was written based on interviews, based on historical research that I put together earlier this year to have a text available for people trying to sort their way through the struggle now. And it seemed very relevant back in February, but then when the book was essentially released days after Charlottesville, it was almost eerie. And so hopefully people can use this to make sense of the forms of resistance that are developing to push back against the alt-right.
You wrote it very quickly. Some of it's pretty dense. You have a lot of information in here about the history of fascism, about the history of Antifa. You interviewed a number of anti-fascists. And what is your main goal with the book? It's called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook.
Well, I'd say that there are three goals. The first is I want the general public to have a reference to understand what's going on. There's a lot of misinformation out there. In fact, most of the information out there is really inaccurate. A lot of what journalists have written, especially early on, was very inaccurate. So if you are not sure what's going on, regardless of your politics or perspective, check out the book. It'll flesh out the history and the politics. Second is I want people who are organizing to resist to have a broader geographic and temporal scope to understand where these kinds of politics have come from and situate themselves within it. Look at examples of what different organizers in different countries have done, things that have worked, things that have not worked. And then finally, to really contribute to a historical literature on this, because there isn't much written about post-war anti-fascism in English, especially outside of the UK.
This got so much media attention for obvious reasons during Charlottesville and then Berkeley. What do you think the media get wrong? What's at the top of your list?
Yes, well, it is a long list, but I will give you a couple of things. First, just some really basic things. And when I do interviews with journalists, I often have to spend 40 or 45 minutes just fleshing out the basic foundation to have a conversation. That's how far the gap is. But first, there's an assumption that I think is evident in mainstream coverage of radical politics in general, that Antifa is one single organization with a kind of monolithic structure and like a leadership or a board of directors, but rather it's a kind of politics or an activity of radical self-defense against the far right. So it's important to understand it as a thing that people do. There is no central command. It's a kind of politics. Related to that is a misconception that it's all about masks and violence. Some anti-fascists wear masks sometimes. A lot of them don't a lot of the times. And as you mentioned at the outset, the vast majority of what this kind of work entails is research on the far right, identifying what groups are active where, who they're coordinating with, when they try to hold events, often under innocuous names, you know, like a conference on Western civilization, contacting hotels or venues to shut them down, popular educational work. The list goes on and on. But what is covered is the spectacle that gets the headlines, and it's decontextualized, and related to that is the assumption that this is sort of a new proposition, that Antifa is something that is a 2017 phenomenon, not a tradition with a century of history.
Well, a lot of people don't know the history, and we'll talk about that during today's show. But first, let's go over some basics, because for a lot of people, this is very new. And some people think that Antifa is the black bloc and vice versa. They just don't know the distinctions. So let's just talk about Antifa first. How would you define the Antifa movement present day in the United States?
Well, as I said, it's an activity or a politics. It's a pan-radical left movement that incorporates all sorts of leftists, anarchists, communists, socialists, leftists of all stripes in an activity of self-defense against the far right. In its current form, it largely grows out of a post-war phenomenon in Europe, North America, and elsewhere of groups of punks and radicals and immigrants and anyone who's under attack organizing for self-defense against neo-Nazi skinhead movements, Klan groups, and so forth. And it is a specific variant of anti-fascism that's often referred to as militant anti-fascism that exists at the kind of crossroads of a pan-radical left politics and a direct action strategy and tactics for pushing back. It doesn't think that we can turn to the police or the state or the courts to stop the far right consistently. It argues that popular organizing needs to be part of the solution.
And you write that today's Antifa here in the U.S., these people are picking up in the tradition of where groups left off. And Antifa is one faction of a larger movement against white supremacy that dates back centuries.
Right. So, I mean, we can look at the specific tradition of anti-fascism defined as such, talk about it recently over past decades, talk about it from those who fought back against Mussolini and Hitler in the early 20th century. But I think it's always important to understand anti-fascism as sort of one facet of a broader historical global struggle against white supremacy and genocide. And in that way, peoples in the Americas, indigenous people, Afro-descendant people have been struggling against similar forces since well before this history. And so it's always, I think, important to take a step back and contextualize what we're talking about. And even today, right, Antifa, there are a number of Antifa groups around the country, but most people who are showing up to counter-protests, who are trying to organize against racism, aren't even necessarily part of any specific group or ideology. Mm. And so in that sense, what's really missed by the media is that we have this broader movement against racism. Antifa is one facet of that. Not the biggest, probably not even the most important, but that's what that get lost in the conversation.
I think this is such an important point because, for example, Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville, she was an activist. I mean, she was what you could call an everyday activist. Mm-hmm. The thing that really got me about Charlottesville is that happened right before college started. So you had a lot of young, bright-eyed college students, some first-generation college students of color, who went to that protest to say no to racism.
Right.
And they got lumped. It was sort of this one big Antifa movement in the media, rather than looking at people's different stories about why they showed up, who they are, what drives them.
Right. I mean, agree or disagree with Antifa or any group, it's just one one faction. And at any of these demonstrations in Boston, in Berkeley, in Charlottesville, you have all sorts of people, all sorts of groups showing up. And there are commonalities that are developing, which I'm sure we can get to. But it's important to look at the plurality of what this is and recognize that we all should have an investment in pushing back against white supremacy or fascism, regardless of our political perspective.
For this book, you interviewed 61 current and former anti-fascists from 17 countries in North America. When you interviewed the anti-fascists who are involved in organizing today in the U.S., mm-hmm. do they consider this to be an organized movement?
Well, I'm not sure if the focus on a movement per se is necessarily the focus. I think that most of these folks that I spoke to are also environmentalists or union organizers or involved with Occupy, or the list goes on and on. And so I spoke to one anti-fascist group who explained that over the past year or two, they've been sort of splitting their time between organizing against fascism and organizing against the construction of a gas pipeline where they live. And they focus on one or the other more based on the perceived imminence of the kind of threat they're working against. So I think that that is indicative, and it shows that these folks would really much rather be focusing on constructive work to build a better world. And you can trace the ebbs and flows of anti-fascist organizing in relation to the rise and fall of the far right. And so certainly the growth of the alt-right, the Trump era has emboldened these people, and there's organizing in response to it. But it's not something that, you know, anti-fascist work is at its best when it's off the radar and when it sort of puts itself into extinction by pushing these people out of the public square. So in that way, the aspiration is not necessarily for everyone to be Antifa explicitly, although I do think people should have an investment, as I said, in pushing back against this. So much it is to kind of conduct a firefighting operation to stop an immediate threat.
Today I'm speaking with historian Mark Bray about his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark is a lecturer at Dartmouth, and he starts his book saying that he wishes there were no need for the book. But given what's happening across the country, in fact, some new data just came out, and we'll bring that up later in the show, about people targeting mosques, people targeting the LGBTQ community, Latino students across the country. I mean, this is just hate crimes are on the rise. If you have any questions or comments for Mark about Antifa, the anti-fascist movement, fascism, give us a call at 866-798-8255. We did a couple of shows about what happened when pro-Trump fascists, whatever you want to call them, came to San Francisco and the Bay Area, and they were met by Antifa in San Francisco and Berkeley. What are your thoughts about tactics, overall goals? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Well, let's talk about the word fascism, because so many people have very
right.
different definitions of this. Mm-hmm. And in your book, you write that despite all of the hand-wringing about Trump the fascist from center-left commentators and enraged Clinton supporters, very few really believe that there's any serious chance of a fascistic regime ever materializing in the United States.
Right. So I'm not of the opinion that we have fascism in power, literally understood, explicitly understood in the United States right now. But Trump does have a lot of fascistic qualities. He has been emboldening the far right. He has had figures like Steve Bannon and Sebastian Gorka in the White House, which are very alarming. But I think that if you are concerned, and if you do emphasize the rhetoric of fascism on the rise, then that has a certain set of political obligations related to it. You know, we think back with the Black Lives Matter movement, people of all backgrounds were encouraged to think, what would you have done in the 60s? Think of what you would have done or would have liked to have think you would have done, and do that today to fight back against the police murder of African Americans. Similarly, I think we have to ask ourselves, well, if you were around in the 20s or 30s, what would you imagine that you would have done to have stopped the rise of authoritarianism in Europe? And what would you do today? Now, that's not to say that the situation is exactly the same. No two situations historically ever are. But the way that we make sure never again is by being vigilant, by recognizing that unless we're active, it could happen again in one way or another. And so in that way, I think that we do have an obligation to take this seriously and to organize against Trump and the alt-right, regardless of how we think that should be done.
Now that a couple months have gone by since Charlottesville, and you've done a lot of interviews and debates, and you've had time to really think about the goal of the racists, far-right Trump supporters, do you call them fascists?
Some of them call themselves fascists. I mean, that's important to understand first off. But I tend to focus on sort of the spectrum of the fascistic, in part because even back in the 20s and 30s, it's very hard to definitionally define fascism, in part because fascists adopted and discarded ideas at will. In different eras of the regimes of Mussolini and Hitler, what the ideology, quote-unquote, looked like changed very drastically. And that really enhanced in the post-war period when in the Western world especially, the kind of political effects of calling oneself a fascist or a Nazi that was very much out of favor. There were experiments done with adopting ideas from all sorts of left movements. You can see with the French New Right the influence of saying, okay, if there can be black power, then why not white power, understood not necessarily explicitly as superior so much as equal in this imagined world of communities. Let's have a white ethno-state on our own because white people have the same rights as other peoples, taking a page out of the book of national liberation struggles, which is all very much a facade. It is white supremacy, but that's what you see with the sort of Richard Spencer and other folks about white nationalism, is trying to sort of portray white people as this interest group without recognizing the sort of colonial and imperial roots of whiteness.
So given that historical context, how do you analyze, for example, the young men we saw in Charlottesville with the khakis and the white shirts and the red Make America Great Again hats, who were marching saying Jews will not replace us?
Right. So victimization is at the heart of fascism historically, and it is today. What white supremacists and fascists are trying to do in different ways is portray movements for social justice that push back against misogyny, that push back against white supremacy, as attempting to murder or kill men or white people. And that's the sort of the made-up notion of white genocide, that if we have a multicultural society, that means that somehow white people will be exterminated, which, of course, is a way of conflating whiteness with white people. But that's a whole nother conversation. So in that way, Jews will not replace us is a way to feed into the kind of angst and insecurity regarding the destruction of the historical privileges of men, of white people, of other kind of dominant groups by movements for social justice, and portraying that as a victimization and trying to tap into the alienation of largely young white men who feel like they are no longer the masters of the universe. And so certainly social justice movements need to say, well, the privileges that you're trying to defend are destructive and oppressive. And if we want an equal, multicultural, diverse, feminist world, you can't be the master of the universe. I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean that we're trying to kill all men or kill all white people. So that's sort of how it's mistaken and misphrased. But they're trying to tap into that angst and resentment.
Mark Bray is author of the new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. You can join us at 866-798-8255. If you're a member of Antifa or you consider yourself anti-fascist, if you went to one of the rallies in Berkeley and San Francisco to shut down the rallies by the Trump supporters, racists, fascists, depending on what you call them, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Rose. During the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement, the successful strategy to build opposition to the war was through mass movement, mass marching, mass resistance to the Vietnam War, through draft people who tore up their draft cards, et cetera, et cetera. Part of the problem with the Antifa and the anarchist approach is that we've seen that in the Occupy demonstrations in downtown Oakland, where anarchists become violent and start smashing windows and setting fires and beating up people, and suddenly the people you want to have at demonstrations, the moms with baby strollers and ordinary normal citizens that come out and show mass support for for civil rights and mass opposition against fascism disappears, and all you have left are the guys dressed in black with their hoods, and the masses don't show up. Tell me why you think this is your strategy is a better strategy than mass opposition movement.
Thank you. Well, I'm very much in favor of mass opposition movements. And in fact, in my first book, Translating Anarchy, I document how anarchists played really key roles in the New York and other encampments in fomenting the most profound mass movement the United States had seen at that point in a number of years. So I think certainly we can have situations where there are movements that entail militant direct action strategies and also generate popular support. Certainly, we can see in the examples of the anti-fascist movements in Spain or France, situations where anti-fascists who are part of affinity groups also help to organize neighborhood assemblies and union-based anti-fascist formations. In the U.S. right now, there are union-based anti-fascist formations associated with the Industrial Workers of the World and other groups. Solidarity and Defense is a network of more popularly based anti-fascist formations in Michigan. And so I think that there is room for a variety of strategies and perspectives. When it comes to resisting the far right, I think it's especially important to be ready for the potential violence that far right groups will unleash. We can see recently that the students counter-protesting Richard Spencer in Florida, that some neo-Nazis opened fire on them. An anti-fascist was shot in the stomach in January at the University of Washington. There was the murder of Heather Heyer, and the list goes on and on. So I think that reasonable people can disagree about what tactics and strategies can look like, but I think especially when militancy is done at either a different time or a different place from where mass demonstrations are gathered, so that there is a space for people who don't want to be part of that to be somewhere else. I think that's kind of a useful framework for understanding how to kind of have a variety, because ultimately we're never going to all agree on how to do this. In my mind, the question is, how can people of good faith who oppose fascism and white supremacy find ways to accommodate each other in a mass movement that really pushes back against efforts to make these hateful perspectives normalized in society?
Thank you for calling in, John. Mark, as you write in your book, fascist movements of the past could not have survived without a layer of public support. And
right.
They might start off small and nonviolent, and then they grow and become violent. And so the anti-fascist that you interviewed said that we don't want to get to that point.
Right.
So that the goal is to shut it down immediately. Based on what we saw in Charlottesville, Berkeley, San Francisco, they were going to come to San Francisco, and then they fled, and then they had a small press conference in Chrissy Field. How did that affect the movement's ability to continue to grow?
Well, I think that, you know, it's important to understand that fascism attempts to portray its values as universal and eternal. The values of masculinity, the values of the nation, the values of the white identity or what have you, as essential, whereas they're all socially constructed. And so today what it tries to do is tap into resentment and portray its ideas not as outside of the norm, but as the true embodiment of the norms of society. And in that way, efforts to dress in khakis and to portray this kind of alt-right as respectable and middle class and intellectual is to try and tap into this resentment and make it seem mainstream. If you prevent, in whatever way you can, these kinds of demonstrations from happening, these speakers from being able to normalize these values, it prevents these movements from being able to harness popular resentment and portray their warped solutions to it as the norm. So I think certainly popular counter-protests are a way of saying, no, we reject these values, we reject these ideas, we are strong, multicultural, diverse communities. But the other part of it, though, that I think needs to always be part of the conversation is, if you look at the historical rise of these authoritarian fascist movements in the 20s and 30s, there came a time when self-defense was necessary, and there were plenty of people arguing against self-defense, even as genocide was underway. And so I think it needs to be on the table, but as a last resort.
Today, I'm speaking with Mark Bray about his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Mark is a lecturer at Dartmouth. He was one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street. He believes scholars and writers have a responsibility to stand up to fascism. What questions do you have about Antifa, the anti-fascist movement, and the tactics? If you are a member of Antifa or are involved in this movement, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kal.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Mark Bray. He's a lecturer at Dartmouth. He was an organizer of Occupy Wall Street, and he's out with a new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He says that scholars and writers have a responsibility to stand up to fascism. His book is an unabashedly partisan call to arms that aims to equip a new generation of anti-fascists with the history and the theory necessary to defeat the far right. And Mark has a number of events coming up. He'll be speaking tonight at the East Bay Booksellers, 5433 College Avenue in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. He'll be in Davis tomorrow. November 16th, he'll be in Palo Alto. He'll also be at City Lights in San Francisco, November 16th at 7:30. And then the Howard's Inn Book Fair is taking place November 19th. It's a day-long, really great event with a number of writers and people talking about the issues of the day, and he'll be there at 12:15. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kal.org. We're going to get to calls in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you about Golden Dawn in Greece. This kind of goes along with the argument that you're making. A lot of people say ignore them, and anti-fascists say until when. And you write that in Greece, Golden Dawn burst out of nowhere to become a major force poised to lead a government before criminal charges decimated party leadership in 2013. They might bounce back yet. We can't be sure.
Yeah, I mean, and they're still a significant party. But that's a situation where this essentially fascist political party was a micro-party for decades until the financial crisis in 2008, and they ballooned into this large party. And I spoke to anti-fascists in Greece who were kicking themselves for not taking them more seriously earlier. And I think to some small extent we can see some parallels even with the Trump election in the U.S., where in the popular discourse, in mainstream media, the arguments made against Trump's positions seem definitive. People who spend a lot of their day focusing on mainstream media thought that this was an open and shut election. And it seems to be, to some extent, to be a situation where even though obviously the popular vote went in Clinton's direction, the fact that you have such a significant number of people not buying into these seemingly rational arguments shows that it isn't always sufficient to simply assume that rationality and good argumentation is going to be enough to present certain political outcomes.
Let's go to our next caller. My machine just crashed, so can you just send me a caller? Hi, can you say your name and where you're calling from?
Yes, hello. My name is Marco.
Hi, Marco.
Hi, calling from San Francisco, California. I'm a longtime anti-fascist activist, and I wanted, though, to mention one is that in this conversation I haven't heard, and maybe I joined late, the tragic events that happened in Greensboro, where a group of communists were murdered in the streets by Klansmen, and they got off scot-free. So this is nothing new. This is, in fact, defensive action on the part of the left that we're taking. But I did want to mention that, you know, where do some of these newer Antifa folks draw the line between a conservative speaker versus a fascist speaker that needs to be resisted? You know, Spencer, fascist, Milo, I'm not so sure. And so I'm curious to see what this newer generation thinks about that ideological demarcation line.
Great question. Yes, so certainly the Greensboro massacre is one of the most notable tragedies in the fascist anti-fascist struggle in the late 70s, when Klansmen and Nazis opened fire on a group of communists who were in Greensboro in solidarity with a labor demonstration and were holding a death to the Klan event. And the police were there. They saw what happened, didn't intervene, raises a lot of questions about police complicity and what happened. Now, as far as the second part where are the lines, who ought to be deprived of a platform? I think it's also important to emphasize at the outset that most of militant anti-fascist organizing over the past decades has been focused on groups more so than individuals, and in that way it's a slightly different consideration. But for many years, a lot of groups have focused on shutting down events by the Holocaust denier David Irving, which served not only to, of course, promote an erroneous notion of history, but served as organizing hubs for fascists and Nazis to get together. Similar things happen today with events by Richard Spencer or Milo Yiannopoulos, which is something that's often overlooked in the public conversation, is it's not just about who's on the stage. It's also about what's happening in the audience, who's getting some information from a local white power group or what have you. Now, anti-fascists don't only organize against textbook fascists who agreed with everything that Mussolini thought in 1920. They organize against the far right more broadly. Certainly, Milo Yiannopoulos has a long track record of misogynist and Islamophobic and transphobic and pro-rape culture kinds of perspectives that are really heinous and reprehensible. He outed a transgender student at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Berkeley University officials stated that he planned to do the same to undocumented students when he spoke in February. I'm not especially interested in whether or not he can fit into a sort of 1920s definition of fascism, but certainly I think that anti-fascists who find what he's doing as reprehensible are correct. And the recent article put out by BuzzFeed that shows Yiannopoulos' role in networking with five or six of the leading neo-Nazis and fascists in drafting the statement on what is the alt-right for Breitbart demonstrate his, at the very least, sympathies. A video was also released of him singing, I think it was God Bless America, in front of a group of Sieg Heiling Nazis at a karaoke bar. So it's not much of a stretch.
You also point out that when Yiannopoulos spoke at or was going to speak at UC Berkeley, he threatened to name undocumented students and a number of undocumented students who were afraid to leave their dorm room. Some even left.
That's correct.
Well, thank you for calling. Let's go to our next caller, Karen in San Francisco. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I didn't know much about Antifa until Trump, whom I despise, started talking about it. So I went online and I did some research, and I have to say I was appalled at what I saw on videos in Berkeley and other cities. I did not see people defending or protecting. I saw people provoking and attacking. And it struck me as extremely antithetical to democratic values. I don't agree with what these fascists, Nazis, neo-Nazis, troubled people were saying, but they do have a right to get together and say it. And it's our duty, I think, to listen with compassion and try and change things. And what I saw was just provocation. In fact, it reminded me a lot. I'm old enough to remember Weather Underground and Bader-Meinhof and, you know, SLA. It reminded me of that kind of crazy violence, which is not constructive. And if you look at history, you see Dr. Martin Luther King, and in particular Mahatma Gandhi, who brought the British Empire to its knees by nonviolence. And so I think that the Antifa movement is going in the wrong direction, and there needs to be liberal people like myself who are not afraid to speak out and call it. And I guess I would finish by quoting the Buddha, which is that hate is never cured by hate, but by love alone is healed. And that's the principle that we need to keep in mind here.
Well, thank you for calling, Karen. We have a similar email from Greg, and then you can respond,
sure.
Mark. Greg says, once you leave the decision when to use violence as completely up to each member of a crowd, you have a mob. Nonviolence is highly disciplined. Antifa are just a bunch of angry people. Why are they angry? Are they sophisticated or ignorant? Do they have operational principles? It almost guarantees a violent outcome. Any individual who's angry enough can light the match. Under what conditions is violence allowed, or do you just beat the crap out of anyone who makes you angry? It's insane.
Okay. So a couple of points to address. First, the question of legality and rights. So fascists and white supremacists clearly have the right to assemble and express their opinions. Legally, there's no question about that. The question is, does a strictly legal anti-fascist strategy always work when you look at the track record of the fact that Mussolini and Hitler both gained power largely legally? The legislation that gave Hitler absolute power, the Enabling Act, was passed by Parliament. So if they had the right to free speech back then, would those anti-fascists who attempted to shut down fascist or Nazi events and thereby infringe upon the legal rights of these groups to present their messages, would that be something that one would disagree with? Well, I think that given the outcomes of what these kinds of movements did, murdering millions of people, that shutting them down, even if it was an abrogation of their legal rights, was a morally justified thing to do. So in that sense, I don't think that an anti-fascist strategy can always be strictly legal, considering that legality, parliamentary politics, and the state have often been a red carpet towards these movements advancing. Related to that is the question of violence and nonviolence. So it is true that nonviolent movements have had a great amount of success, and usually nonviolence, the vast majority of times, is the way to go. The question is, how do they work? They work by generating public opinion and public support for an opinion in an effort towards influencing the decisions of those in power. So in the case of Gandhi, there was enough public opinion and public support to be generated in Britain and the British Empire to push the government away from a colonial policy over time. The question is, would that have worked, for example, in Nazi Germany? Was there a public opinion powerful enough to be leveraged to stop the killing machine of Hitler and the Nazis? I don't think so. And so in that way, I think certainly self-defense was legitimate in the 40s. I think the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising is one of the most dramatic and righteous examples of self-defense that I can think of. The question is, how bad does it have to get for that to become legitimate if you are not an absolute pacifist? Because if you are, then that's a different conversation. And to me, I'm convinced by the anti-fascist argument that it needs to be on the table from the beginning, because it's much easier and more effective to resist when these groups are marginal than once they have state power behind them.
To Greg's point about the end goal of the groups, how do they make decisions behind the scenes? You point out in your book that in 2008, the Central Texas Antifa group that was going to a demonstration by the National Socialist Movement in Tyler, Texas, there was a woman of color in that group named Maya, and she pushed the idea of performance instead of beatdowns. And a lot of the men thought that was ridiculous, but they ended up doing it, and they were successful.
Right, yeah. And so I think most of the time, if you can shut down a group, if you can deprive them of the opportunity of expressing themselves with noise demonstrations, where was it? I think in Tennessee, where they sang La Bamba over what the Nazis were trying to say. Even the example of kind of the poop protest, I think it was out here, right, where people brought the feces from their dogs to the park so that the demonstration couldn't occur. There's a million ways to do this, and certainly people should pursue the ways that they feel comfortable with. There's no one size fits all on this.
Well, thank you for calling in, Karen. To that point, we have an email from, a caller, Stoss in Oakland. Hi, Stoss. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. This is Stoss. I've been a long time activist, demonstrator for 30 years, primarily in Los Angeles, but some in the Bay Area as well. And I've always been in part of and encouraging creative ways to bring art and performance, visual art and performance, and to make demonstrations powerful and effective. I think the Antifa music movement right now, from what we see, is really problematic because I don't see the discipline. I'm proud of them if they consider themselves security in a sense, fighting fire with fire, but I would look to more disciplined activist security examples like the Brown Berets and the Black Berets, who have been parts of movements and the Nation of Islam, also security details, and they're very disciplined and it doesn't end up in violence and not success, because right now I see Antifa's hijacking these planned peaceful movements that people put a lot of effort into doing. I mean, it isn't encouraging the mass people to come out because they don't want to be a part of violence and put their family and their children at risk. And if you just want to go do a fight, if these two groups, the right and the left, want to fight, then they should just go rent the MGM in Las Vegas and have a boxing match, because, or do that activity outside of these protests and accept the consequences. You know, instead of hiding behind the crowd of what's supposed to be a plan to be a peaceful protest.
Thank you, Stoss.
Well, I would be curious to know what Stoss thinks about the comments made by Cornel West and other clergy that the anti-fascists saved their lives in Charlottesville when hundreds of armed neo-Nazis were charging into the crowd and beating people into a coma. So, I mean, the question is, what do you do when you counter-protest the far right and they're violent? Because that happens rather frequently. I think people need to be ready for self-defense. That doesn't mean they have to be part of an Antifa group, but it does mean that that is a consideration. And really, in my experience interviewing these folks, the kind of time commitment that it requires to be part of one of these groups is akin to the time commitment of being a second job. A lot of what they actually put their time into is essentially being like private investigators, researching who these groups are. There is a lot of time and discipline put into sometimes self-defense training, martial arts training. There is a lot of discussion and tactical strategizing about how to go about confronting these groups when that is necessary. And so I just think that people are making a lot of assumptions without really having the information. I'd encourage people to read my book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, to really get a sense of what these people are, whether you agree or disagree.
Thank you for the call, Stas. Today we're joined by Mark Bray talking about his new book, Antifa. Mark is a lecturer at Dartmouth, and he's got a number of events coming up. You can find specific information at yourcallradio.org. He'll be at the East Bay Booksellers event tonight at 7 o'clock, 5433 College Avenue in Berkeley. In Davis tomorrow, Palo Alto, November 16th. The evening of November 16th at 7:30, he'll be at City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco, and then he'll be at the Howard Zinn Book Fair on November 19th in San Francisco at 12:15. You can find information at yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Judith who says, there's something that greatly concerns me about the anti-fascist movement. In Charlottesville, the marchers chanted, "Jews will not replace us." As a Jew, I find it disturbing that these movements don't talk about the rise of anti-Semitism. Can you talk a little bit about this? I was actually surprised that this didn't get more attention. I mean, we saw the Nazi salute. We saw swastikas so much at Charlottesville. I was really surprised that that did not get more attention.
Yeah, it should. And the defamation of Jewish cemeteries, attacks on synagogues, it is a huge concern. And in my experience, the anti-fascists I spoke to are attuned to it and have been talking about it, and also are aware of the ways in which, for a lot of these weird fascists, their kind of anti-blackness, their anti-Jewishness, anti-immigration perspectives are all sort of linked together under what they imagine is a Jewish world conspiracy. So these are all interlinked, and they all need to be talked about together. So it is a huge problem, and anti-Semitism has not gone away. And
she says, what's the most effective way to respond to anti-Semitism?
Well, I don't think there is one way. I think with all of these, the point that I try to emphasize more than anything is there are a plurality of ways of fighting racism, fascism, and white supremacy, and people should choose those that they feel are most effective and comfortable. But, you know, part of it is emphasizing that anti-Semitism is simply not a perspective that we're going to tolerate. Being intolerant of intolerance and saying that, you know, if you promote these anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, you're going to be a pariah from society. We're not going to accept this, and we're going to try and push you away. But the other part of it, of course, is also to try and promote a kind of anti-racist consciousness, popular education, talk about how we're all just people.
Well, thank you for the call. I mean, thank you for the email. I mentioned this new study that recently came out, and I'm just reading from the Washington Post. More hate crimes were carried out in the U.S. last year, with an uptick in incidents motivated by bias against Jews, Muslims, and LGBT people. This is according to FBI data. More than 6,100 incidents of hate crimes in 2016, up from 5,800 the year before. And who knows how many of these crimes are not considered hate crimes or were not reported, right? Well, let's go next to Eleanor in Berkeley. Hi, Eleanor. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I went out to the, well, 2 days, a day of protest in San Francisco, and then there was a following day in Berkeley, and I went to Ohlone Park, and I encountered the Antifa crowd, and there was a very bizarre speaker asking the demonstrators to make strange agreements, and these were things like, we will not speak to the press. We will not take photographs. And I assumed that this was part of that Antifa group. So I spoke to some of the masked youth who had shown up there. And the first few that I tried to engage were too tense to speak. And another engaged my neighbor, and she asked him a question that they seemed poised for violence. And he said, property damage is not violence, to which she responded, so does that mean you could nonviolently burn down my house? So when this speaker, your guest, says we need that a legal argument isn't always effective, maybe, but a moral argument always is. And for them to cede moral ground and to make a statement like everyone needs to just do what makes them feel safe and free with no boundary on what that means, that could be a statement from the NRA. So I see that as a dangerous thing. And in my mind, you can take off to the left or you can take off to the right, but it is a circle. And you can meet at the top with identical tactics. And I'm just highly suspicious that they're ceding moral ground, which I know violence may produce a thrilling short-term win, but it's moral ground that always wins in the end.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I keep emphasizing that it's important not to let the conversation drift too far away from what the most heinous and reprehensible outcomes of fascist and white supremacist politics have been historically in genocide and slavery and so forth. And so the question is, was it legitimate for Jews or other victims of the Nazi regime to fight back? Was that morally problematic in the case of concentration camp uprisings in cases of slave rebellions? I think the opposite. I think that those are morally righteous examples of self-defense that entailed violence. So the question is when, from my perspective, when, not if, there are cases when this is morally acceptable. As far as the question of property destruction, I think that what is or is not violence is socially and historically constructed, and so in that sense is a matter of popular perspective. But some people argue that property destruction is not violence. That's their opinion. But to me, obviously, we always need to understand any action, whether destruction of property, a confrontation, in terms of the values and politics that underlie it, and not simply look at tactics in the absence of politics and values, because that's when you lead to this bizarre notion of equating fascism with anti-fascism simply because both sometimes entail confrontations. But really, I mean, we live in a violent society ruled by police and prisons and military. So the notion that what we have is not already violent, I think, is missing the bigger picture.
And Nazism started out with how many people?
Well, when Hitler attended his first meeting of the German Workers' Party before the name change to the Nazi Party, the party had 54 members at the time.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about women in the Antifa movement.
Sure.
You write a little bit about feminism. I wish you would have gone a little deeper into it, but talk a little bit about the conversations you had with women members.
Right. Well, I mean, I think any movement, well, really anything in a patriarchal society, patriarchy is predominant and prevalent. But especially when it comes to movements that entail confrontation, I think it's especially a concern. So I asked everyone I interviewed, what's done in your group to deal with feminism, to deal with potentials for machismo and masculinity running rampant? And it seems that certainly back in the 80s and the 90s, there have been groups that my interview subjects claimed didn't do very good at this. More recently, those that I spoke to emphasized that some groups have gender-based discussion groups. Others are predominantly led by women. And a lot of the women I spoke to emphasized that for them, self-defense and sort of taking upon themselves the kind of, I guess you could call, violence that society assumes that women are incapable of was for them to some extent liberating. And so I think it's important to not always assume that self-defense against white supremacists and misogynists is necessarily masculine or anti-feminist, because that's certainly not the perspective of the women that I spoke to. That having been said, it's hard to say with any definitive sense exactly what the demographics are of these groups, because they don't publicize who they are.
You write that women face a variety of gender challenges when they take an active part in this movement, and that's part of the reason why some German Antifa have created feminist groups called Fontifa.
Right. So clearly there was a need for feminist Antifa in Germany in the 90s. Otherwise, these groups wouldn't have been formed. And so that certainly is indicative of the limitations of a feminist politics in that context, but also an interesting response. And there are Fontifa groups in Austria and Germany today. I think it's an interesting way of dealing with the issue, because ultimately, as a society, we're dealing with patriarchy and white supremacy, and so certainly that's going to find its way into all the crevices of what we do.
What about people of color in Antifa?
Yeah, I mean, some of the groups that I spoke to claim to be majority people of color. Certainly, though, there is a popular perception that this is something that white people do. And so that perception can become a reality in its own sense. Some of the people of color that I've spoken to, some of the activists that have come out to my events, have emphasized that from their perspective, there is a value in white people putting their bodies on the line to stop fascists and white supremacists from organizing. Nevertheless, it's hard to say too much either way, but I think that, as I said earlier on, there is a place in this broader anti-racist movement for all sorts of people. Mm-hmm. And if some white youth feel like Antifa is a vehicle for that, then I think that that's great.
We had a lot of callers today who say that they oppose the tactics used by Antifa, and I'm sure that some of the Antifa members who do environmental work, workers' rights work, they rub shoulders with a lot of the people who called in today, right?
Of course.
So what are their thoughts about not so much how the media responds, but how people who are, quote, on their side oppose their tactics? What do they think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, some people do, some people don't. I think also there's a learning process going on now, because a lot of people, even leftists, don't necessarily know much about this. And so in my experience speaking to members of Antifa groups and other kinds of anti-racist and anti-fascist formations, there is a learning experience that goes on when, in the case of Charlottesville, anti-fascists are charging and Antifa step up to defend them.
And what's next for the movement? Things have been kind of quiet the last couple months.
Well, you know, as I said, anti-fascism rises and falls in response to what fascism does. We'll see what the alt-right does. It'd be great if basically fascism fades from memory in 5 years. We'll say, oh, remember when that was an issue? Fortunately, it's not now. Unfortunately, there's something else we need to do.
Well, Steve Bannon gave a keynote at the California Republican Convention last month.
Well, any Republicans listening, do what you can to push white supremacists and fascists out of your movement.
Mark Bray is a longtime activist. He's a lecturer at Dartmouth, and his new book is Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. He'll be speaking tonight in Berkeley at the East Bay Booksellers event, 5433 College Avenue at 7 o'clock. He'll be in Davis tomorrow, November 16th, in Palo Alto. City Light, San Francisco, 7:30, November 16th, and the Howard's Inn Book Fair, November 19th at 12:15 in San Francisco. Mark, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. Thanks to Ali Budner for producing today's show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.